And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Dr. TJ Williams, and with me, as always, is Aaron.
Hi.
very talkative, Aaron. So today we're just going to dive in. Today we're going to be talking about a topic that we actually get lots of questions regarding.
I feel like we say that every time.
Yeah, I think we do.
That's because it's really how we pick our shows.
It's exactly right. But, well, this week we've got a lot of questions on this, so let's talk about that. So this is one that it's kind of funny. So this is not something that people call the office with complaints of or that they want help with. This is a topic, what we're talking about today is a topic that comes out during our investigation of what the person actually has going on. Because what we're talking about today is SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. SIBO, S-I-B-O for short. And so what happens is, people don't really want to call in and talk about their bowel habits. And so those things happen when we talk to them in private, in our consultation meetings, and we figure out that their bowel habits are all kinds of all over the place. And a little bit later on in the show, we're going to talk about symptoms and things that happen if you're experiencing bacterial overgrowth.
Right. And some people will also be experiencing symptoms, we'll look it up and then we'll come in and say, I think I might have SIBO. And then we, you know, you can get into, oh, okay, you know, why do you think? But it's kind of a way for them to broach the subject of, you know, yeah, there are things going on with my bowel habits that,
right.
You know, I think that we need
to
discuss.
You know, it's funny. I, again, this is just one of those things that it cracks me up because this is not what people typically want to talk about at all. And like it's becomes this topic and we bring it up and we're like, okay, so now we have to talk about the difficult stuff. And then we start talking about bowel habits. And it's like people are embarrassed about that topic in general. And I mean, after listening to a lot of people talk about it, I see why. I mean, there are a lot of people that are walking around with bowel problems.
And I think that's not going to be surprising to a lot of people. First of all, I mean, a lot of people listening are probably experiencing them.
Yeah, the number one thing that we hear from once we talk to people, our patients, is how can I get my coworkers to come in here?
Right. Well, and that was going to be my point. I mean, we've all probably, I mean, I don't have that issue with the, you know, current firm that I'm with, but I have been in offices where I'm just like, somebody needs to help these people. Like, I need to give them all business cards because this is ridiculous.
Yeah. Or stop at any travel plaza on a road trip somewhere and I just want to hand out business cards left and right.
Right. I mean, that's not all we're talking about today. Obviously, we have actually discussed doing a whole show at some point just on, you know, bowel habits in general.
Yeah.
And what is normal and what is not normal, because we have discovered that a lot of people are
what is normal is not healthy.
Right. I mean, people have gotten so far from what is normal that when you tell them what is normal, they're just like, that's not possible. Nobody's like that. And you're like, that's a really bad sign. If you're that far gone that you don't even see this. But anyway, today we're just talking about SIBO.
Yeah. So this bacterial overgrowth, I mean, we have to have bacteria in our gut. We have bacteria throughout our entire body. In fact, the number of bacteria that we have in our system outweighs the number of cells or outnumbers the number of cells that are actually us. So we have this symbiotic relationship with bacteria in our body. And our small intestines and our large intestines have the vast majority of these bacteria. Now, we're going to get into, you know, things, like I said earlier, we're going to talk in a bit about symptoms associated with SIBO, this bacterial overgrowth. And we're also going to talk about, like, things that can put you at risk for developing SIBO. That's just as important, too, is knowing what you can be doing and what you are doing, what you're not doing that can create an increased risk. But talking about the small intestine, the small bowel, this thing, it's what connects the stomach to the large intestine. So we have it goes stomach, small intestine, large intestine. The small intestine itself, just from some statistics for you, it's about 20 feet long. Yeah, think about that. That's a whole lot of feet in your belly. It really, truly is.
all like coiled up, not coiled up, but I mean, you know, kind of. I'm just
wound all up in there, just kind of all different kinds of directions. There's no rhyme or reason to it. It's just in there. It does its thing. There's a lot of bacteria that are normally present, like I said, throughout the whole tract, but it's in various areas of the GI tract. It has, you have different levels and different types of bacteria. So really in the small bowel, in the small intestine, you actually have very little in relation to the large intestine. You have very small amounts or very little amounts of bacteria. You really only have about 10,000 bacteria per milliliter of fluid. And for those of you who don't know what a milliliter of fluid looks like, it's a little bigger than a typical drop of, like if you think of a large drop of water, a little larger than that is a milliliter. It's not much, right? And so 10,000 bacteria live in that. And if you compare that to the bacteria content in the large intestine, there's like a billion in that same number of fluid. It's just there's so much more bacteria in the large intestine than there is in the small. And so the types of bacteria that are normally present in the small intestine are different from those in the large intestine, right? So how do I want to transition through this? So the small intestine is extremely important for digesting and absorbing food. So a big majority of your small intestine is where we absorb the biggest majority of our food. So when food passes from the stomach into the small intestine, the small intestine has three distinct areas. It has the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum. And so the duodenum is the very first section of the small intestine. And most of your absorption of your nutrients happens within the first 12 inches of that thing. That's the first foot. Remember, we said earlier that the small intestine is 20 feet long. The first foot is where you get the vast majority of absorption. This is where we have the stomach juices and things that have, you know, we've digested our food and it's set in the stomach and it's mixed with all this acid, the hydrochloric acid in our stomach. As it moves into the small intestine, we have the bile from our gallbladder and we have the pancreas. It creates its own digestive enzymes. They mix together. And when those things mix together, it creates these chemical reactions. And so what that means is that's really important for people that are using like antacids, over-the-counter antacids, like Rolaids or Tums or something like that. Those things aren't really good for you because that takes the pH. It's really important to have that pH change from a really acidic pH of 1 or 2 in the stomach to being neutralized to a pH of around 7 to 7.4 or 5 in the very beginnings of the small intestine. When you don't have that pH change, you don't release the nutrients. And so all that food just kind of passes on through and you don't really absorb the nutrients from the food. That's a big deal because if you're taking an antacid, you're taking the pH of your stomach and you're artificially raising it up to 7. So when the food passes from the stomach to the small intestine, the gallbladder doesn't know, hey, I got to release some bile to digest the stuff here. And the pancreas doesn't know, hey, I've got to release some digestive enzymes from me to help break this food down. That transition doesn't happen. And so when you don't have that shift, you don't digest you don't absorb your nutrients. Well, now you've set the entire small intestine all the way through to the large intestine up for massive amounts of problems, and you set it up for crazy amounts of bacterial overgrowth.
Which is one of the reasons why SIBO is becoming so much more of a problem, because antacid use has gone up dramatically. And if you are concerned about, you know, if you're wondering, okay, how do I go without an antacid? I definitely need it. I have GERD, or, you know, I've been told that I have to take this. Go back and listen to our show. We've done a previous show on heartburn and antacids. And
it's not from the vast majority of you out there, it's not of too much acid in your stomach. It does happen. It's extremely rare. Most people have way too little acid in their stomach, and that's what causes this stuff the pressure to build up.
And what's terrifying is, I mean, of course this is a problem when we're talking about adults, but more and more we are seeing kids who are told, oh, they have GERD, and then they're put on medications. Think about what that does to a human body if from, you know, shortly after birth, they're put on medication that's stopping the natural process from taking place.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you have...
Talk about stunting growth and screwing up hormones.
Right. And of course they're going to have problems down the line. And I mean, and we're certainly not criticizing parents who are putting their kids on these medications because that's what they're told is they're supposed to do.
Right.
But if you're listening to this and you know someone who has a child, you know, if you have a child who has GERD or you know someone who does, pass this information along because it's that important.
Right. And so not only is the small intestine important for things like that, but we also, a big chunk of your immune system lives there. We have all these lymphoid cells that are there. These things help fight infections. They help regulate our immune system. This normal occurring bacteria that's supposed to be there, it's an extremely essential part of a healthy small intestine function. So we have to have it for our small intestine, our small bowel to function the way it's supposed to. They protect us against bad bacteria and yeast that we eat. They help our body absorb nutrients. So like I said before, this is where we create these chemical reactions that take place. There's these hormones and enzymes that all kind of work together, help us make certain nutrients and absorb certain nutrients. And it helps us to maintain the normal muscular activity of our bowel, the stuff that helps us move material through our small intestine and into our large intestine. It's a process called peristalsis. So there are a lot of really important things that are going on here. Now, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about what SIBO is and things that can put you at risk for SIBO. You're listening to Wellness 101. And welcome back to the show, everyone. If you're just tuning in, today we are talking about SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It's a lovely, lovely topic that everyone likes to talk about. Actually, no one likes to talk about it. They don't even like to talk about it when we have to for going over someone's health history. But it's critical that we discuss this, because there are a lot of people, I think, out there that are dealing with SIBO symptoms and problems related to this bacterial overgrowth. They've just unknowingly set themselves up for their bacteria in their gut to get out of balance. So, before the break, we were talking about why these bacteria are so beneficial in the small intestine. They help protect us. It's part of our immune system, help us absorb nutrients, and help with the normal muscular activity of moving material through the small intestine. The question so many people ask, even after we've kind of gone through it, is they're like, okay, so still, what is SIBO? I don't really understand. And really, it's in the name itself. It's just bacterial overgrowth. It's normally occurring bacteria in the small intestine that grow in numbers and have a higher population than they're supposed to. So sometimes we can have changes in the type of bacteria, but it's most often an increase in number of bacteria. So it's typically not caused by just one single type of bacteria, but it's an overgrowth of various different types of bacteria that should normally be found in the colon or the large intestine. So what happens is this bacteria gets moved into the wrong spot. It's this stuff can migrate around and move, and that's the issue. Now, it's much less, more less common, but SIBO can result from otherwise an increase in otherwise normal bacteria in the small bowel. So it can be from bacteria that's in the small intestine that get out of control, but more often it's bacteria that are normally found in the large intestine that get into the small intestine and overpopulate.
Right. So you can have bacteria that is normally in the small intestine in a certain amount, and it's just kind of gone out of whack. And so it's grown much bigger than what it should be in there. Or what is more common is stuff from the colon. You've got this bacteria that is normally in the colon, and it's found its way into the small intestine.
Yeah. Mysterious migrating bacteria.
Right. And I mean, you know, like we've talked about before, I mean, these are beneficial bacteria. There are reasons why we have them in our body, but they're supposed to be in specific places. I mean, that makes sense, right?
And specific numbers.
Right, exactly.
So it's all about, this stuff is really all about balance. So
right, our whole body is a very finely tuned machine.
It is.
And something gets off and we need to correct it. And that's, again, why, you know, their prescription medications generally are not the way, you know, if we can just get you back into balance, which is certainly possible, it definitely is with SIBO, then your body will begin functioning again like normal. It wants to function how a body is supposed to function.
Right. And so, yeah, that's exactly right. The body's trying to keep itself in balance. It's the things that we're doing to it that throw it out of balance, and then it does what it can and what it knows to do to try and get back into balance. But if you wiped out an entire species of bacteria, something's got to take its place. And so this is what you end up with, is this overgrowth. So the thing about SIBO is, not only is it this increase in bacteria, but when we have this increase in bacteria, it affects our small intestine, both the structure of our small intestine and the function of the small intestine as well.
Right, so, and the whole structure is, I mean, that was surprising when we were researching this. That's surprising to me. It makes sense to me that the function would be changed, but the fact that the structure is changed as well, I think, is going to be surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right on that. But the important piece of information here is that by damaging these cells, so these bacteria are supposed to be in very specific numbers in very specific regions of the small intestine. Like I said before, the small intestine, three parts, duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. And these things have different numbers of bacteria, and they have these areas of the small intestine also have different types of function that's going on. But if the bacteria aren't in the right spot, the cells of the lining of that area of the small intestine become actually damaged. So you can damage the mucosa of the small intestine, and that's a big, big problem. This is where you can start setting up the body for even things like leaky gut.
Right.
You've altered the barrier of the small intestine. Now, another thing that happens is, so you've damaged this small bowel mucosa, so you've led to the possibility of leaky gut. That's, like I said, that's when the intestinal barrier becomes permeable. We're allowing larger than we should be allowing molecules to pass through this, enter into the bloodstream. Our immune system tags it, and then we start having immune reactions and inflammation at levels that most people don't even really understand. And then that triggers in our autoimmune conditions. So this is kind of the beginning of autoimmune disease. And, you know, we have people that are like, well, I don't really know that I have an autoimmune. Like, well, the problem is this is how you get to autoimmune. We might have caught you before we were able to shut it down, or before we were able to, you know, identify autoimmune condition. But other people come to us, like I just was on the phone with a lady just a couple days ago. And she called. She had read my article in The Healthy Planet. I'd written an article on the thyroid epidemic. And she had called because she had autoimmune thyroid. And so we were talking about this, and she was really asking a lot of very intelligent questions, saying, you know, I'm not really sure why this is. My doctors just finally found this. They've been playing with my medication for years. I about cried. I'm like, playing with your medication for years is scary enough.
But extremely common.
Oh, it's so common. It's not even funny.
Especially with thyroid.
Yeah.
Extremely common. If you're on thyroid medicine or an antidepressant, you're going to have that situation.
Yeah. And so she kept asking, well, how could this happen? How could this happen? And as I was trying to explain it to her, it finally clicked a light bulb, I think, because she was like, okay. So basically she realized that it wasn't her thyroid. Her thyroid broke down as a result of a lot of other things going on that could have been gut related. And
probably was gut-related. It almost always is.
With what we talked about, I guarantee it was gut-related.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's just how that
is.
That's
why we focus so much on the gut, because so much can go wrong if the gut is not working properly.
Right. So now we've got bacteria out of balance. We've got an overgrowth of bacteria. We've altered the lining of the cells, and we've created this leaky gut. So what happens next? The next thing that happens is logical. We've changed our body's ability to absorb nutrients. And now we start seeing functional nutritional deficiencies, or worse, actual nutritional deficiencies, not just functional, not just things that, you know, if you're under stress or if you're going through something, you know, we're seeing like medically low levels of vitamin D, medically low levels of B12, medically low levels of a bunch of different things, and that's cause for concern. Now we've set the body up to where it can't actually function at an optimal level. We're going to start falling apart all over the place. This is where we end up dying in parts and pieces, right? Like B12. I just mentioned B12. Extremely difficult vitamin to absorb. A lot of stuff has to take place. It starts in the mouth. There's stuff that takes place in the stomach. We have to make this stuff called intrinsic factor. We have to get that stuff together into the small intestine. We have to get this stuff bound to B12. Then the B12 has to travel through the small intestine where it gets to the end of the small intestine. It gets released, and then it gets absorbed into the blood where it travels through the liver. It hooks onto these transport proteins called transcobalamins. It's just a disastrous nightmare to move this stuff through. I can almost guarantee you all these people that have functional or medically low levels of B12 have some form of leaky gut that's going on because they're not able to absorb this stuff. It's a multi-step thing that is all revolving around the gut.
Right.
I went off on a 5-minute diatribe there.
Yeah.
And Aaron came back with, right.
Well, it's better than not right. Well, that's why so many people come in and get B12 shots, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, explaining how difficult it is for it to be absorbed. That's why when people are not ready to actually take control and go through what is necessary to correct their gut, they can get some relief by just getting a vitamin B12 shot.
Right.
And we have a lot of people that, you know, that's all they're willing to do. And that's fine. I mean, you know, we're there for them with, you know, I mean, and we do a lot of B12 shots in our office. And it's something that people, you know, see a lot of relief with, and, you know, we do it super cheap. So
right. It's
just, you know, it is what it is, but it's something that, you know, I think is really important and can definitely get off when people have SIBO as well as other issues.
Yeah. And then we move on into like things like protein. Well, if we're not digesting protein, now we're getting into protein deficiency. If we consume the wrong amounts of protein or we're not digesting that properly, then we can get ammonia buildup. And then we've got to detoxify ammonia. Now this should naturally happen, but if things are broken, you're going to have way too much produced. Now we put massive amounts of stress on our body's ability to detoxify, and we already know that detoxification system was being bogged down to begin with. It was under stress. It was being asked to work too hard. And so, you know, we're just saying, look, there's so many things that are affected if you're dealing with this bacterial overgrowths that you've got to get this stuff under control. I mean, we run a lot of comprehensive stool analyses in our office. I mean, a lot of them, because lots of people have dysfunctional guts and bowels. And we find bacterial balance is off so frequently, and symptoms of SIBO and, you know, SIBO diagnoses, it's all over the place. It's rampant. So we got to take another break. When we come back, we're going to talk about some risk factors for SIBO. You're listening to Wellness 101. And welcome back to the show, everyone. If you're just tuning in, we are talking today here on Wellness 101 about SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And before the break, we were just talking about, you know, nutrient deficiencies that can take place and stuff like that. And we wanted to get in this segment and talk about like risk factors. But one of the things I want to talk about before risk factors is how the body has built-in ways to prevent SIBO from taking place. We make stomach acid. That's to help, kill bacteria that we consume. We have our bowels move in waves to help move this stuff along. We have immunoglobulins in our intestinal fluid. So we actually have part of our immune system that's working overtime right there to try and get rid of bacteria that's not supposed to be in, if it's in the wrong spot and not supposed to be there, our immune system will help get rid of that. And then we have a valve that stops the flow of things backwards from our large intestine into our small intestine. It's called the ileocecal valve. And like I said before, the small intestine has three parts, the jejunum, the duodenum, the jejunum, and the ileum. And the ileum is the part that connects into the large intestine. And where it connects into the large intestine is called the cecum. That's why we have the ileocecal valve. It's what separates the small intestine from the large intestine. And so, you know, the how we, someone ends up with SIBO is usually a big old complex mess of things that can take place. And so some of the risk factors that set people up for SIBO would be things like low stomach acid. The number one cause of digestive upset in the country is this condition called atrophic gastritis. That means that our stomach is not making enough acid, and the lining of our stomach becomes inflamed. And so that's a big thing. So we decrease our stomach acid production. Having irritable bowel syndrome.
Wait, on low stomach acid, yeah. Though, does that also include people who would have normal stomach acid but take an acid medication?
Well, that's a fantastic question. And the answer, the short answer is yes. It's a little more complex than that, but yes, you would be affecting the change of pH from the stomach into the small intestine. So, yeah, not having enough stomach acid or taking a substance that raises the pH up to where you have less effective, quote, less stomach acid would do the same or very similar thing. So then we have irritable bowel syndrome. There's celiac disease. Anybody that has celiac disease, it's an autoimmune condition.
Especially long-standing celiac disease. And really, with celiac, I mean, I think most people who have celiac know this. It's probably long-standing because it probably took a long time for anyone to figure it out.
That's right. That's exactly right.
I don't
right.
know anyone who,
To get a diagnosis of celiac disease, you have to have it for a really long time.
Yeah. Or, I mean, sometimes if you have a family member who has it, then they'll go ahead and test you. They can find it a little bit sooner, but that's rare. I mean, right. A lot of times, you know, and as someone who suffers from celiac disease, I know it takes a long time to actually get a diagnosis.
Right. Another one is Crohn's disease, having bowel surgery. So some people have had, segments of their bowel resected or taken out. So those people have trouble. Having diabetes, either type 1 or type 2, is an issue. The one that catches most people is multiple rounds of antibiotics. It takes very few rounds of antibiotics to completely disrupt your entire gut bacteria. And multiple courses of antibiotics. A lot of people come in like, oh my gosh, I was on antibiotics twice a year, every year when I was a kid because I had strep throat, I had ear infections, I had sinus infections. And we're like, yep, that's probably why we have all of these things going on now and your gut's all out of balance. And then other things that can be, so like if we have our entire organ system that's in failure, like liver cirrhosis or pancreatitis or our kidneys are failing, all of these types of things can create, can set us up in our risk factors for developing SIBO as well. But I want to talk a little bit about another risk factor. So we hear lots and lots about a little bit of alcohol consumption, drink some red wine. It's good for the heart. It's good for this. It's good. You know, alcohol is good for this, good for that, good for something else. But the problem is moderate alcohol consumption can lead to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, oral contraceptive use. So women who are taking oral birth control pills, it makes you more susceptible for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth.
And moderate alcohol consumption is defined as one drink a day for women, two drinks a day for men.
Right. And that's exactly what they tell you to consume as far as red wine goes to get the heart health benefits.
Right.
Okay, so are the heart health benefits really outweighing the damage that's going on in your gut and all of the autoimmune conditions that follow? No, it's not. There's not that much benefit. There are a lot of other things that are much more beneficial to your heart, like getting off your keister and taking a walk.
Right.
Call me crazy. Do a little exercise. It's way better for you than the glass of red wine. Plus, if you're drinking alcohol with a meal, you're just completely shutting down your body's ability to absorb vitamin B1. You can't absorb any. I mean, that's the vitamin B1 deficiency is the disease of the alcoholic. Now, I'm not saying one drink a day isn't creating an alcoholic or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But I am saying that if you had one drink a day for year after year after year, the likelihood is you're going to exhibit signs of a B1 deficiency. So just food for thought or drink for thought. So there is a the association between birth control pills and inflammatory bowel disease is moderate. So they're starting to link more and more things to taking birth control pills. And this stuff makes sense. I mean, we're talking about affecting a hormone system. And when you affect the hormones, any hormone, you affect the entire body from head to toe. Because all of these hormones are interrelated. They're linked together. They operate on our system in very powerful ways, and in very small amounts in very powerful ways. And when you mess with one, you're messing with them all. And so you're better off just, you know, try to get, you know, find other ways. Find other ways. So the question that we're kind of left with is, how do you know if you have SIBO? How do you know? What are you experiencing? Well, I can tell you that research says that somewhere between 6 and 15% of healthy people that are asymptomatic, they don't even know that they have it, actually have SIBO. So we have 15% of the healthy population walking around. And I say 15% of the population, it's really interesting because, you know, we've said on the show before, if you're overweight, you're unhealthy. And 66% of the population is overweight. So we're really down to, you know, only 30% of the population are healthy. And half of that number of people are walking around with some sort of SIBO. And so their digestive system is off.
Right. Well, I mean, and we talked about what the risk factors are. I mean, think about it. So many people fall into one of those categories.
Right.
It's extremely common to, you know, have taken multiple courses of antibiotics or, you know, to have low stomach acid or to be taking an acid medication. I mean, it's so common that it's not really that surprising that SIBO has become, you know, so widespread at this point.
Right.
But I think when you talk about how do you know if you have SIBO, I think one of the big things is there isn't a test really for, I mean, isn't it difficult to test?
It is extremely difficult to test. Conventional medicine does things like breath tests and things like that.
Yeah, and I've had that done. And I know, I mean, we talked about the fact that I have celiac. I had so many issues going on. Mine actually came back negative. I probably did have SIBO.
Yeah.
It just wasn't to the extent yet where it was picked up on. I just don't think, I mean, I initially tested negative for celiac too. I mean, and so you at the time.
Right, but they also told you you didn't have autoimmune thyroid and that was raging.
I mean, right. So I was off the charts on that. I mean, and so I'm just saying, I think that a lot of times the conventional medicine, you know, runs tests that give us a false sense of security. And so even if you've had these tests ran, and a lot of people are never tested for, you know, small bacterial overgrowth. I was tested simply because I was having, I think I've talked about this before, I mean, I was struggling to stay over 80 pounds. I'm 5'6", and I was, you know, adamant, I'm eating, something has to be going on. And so when, you know, after going through a colonoscopy and upper endoscopy, I mean, I had all of these tests done. That was another
Those are awesome procedures because that's what everybody wants to have done.
Yeah.
What'd you do today? Oh, I went and had a colonoscopy.
That's
great.
That's not actually as bad as the prep, though. I mean, because at least you're knocked out for the
true.
Colonoscopy.
That's true. I mean, the prep. Yeah.
So.
That should be some punishment that we have reserved for certain people.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we're actually going to prep you for a colonoscopy that's not going to happen tomorrow.
I feel like that's the way they were testing me to make sure, like, is she really... Does she really not feel good? Because no one's going to go, you know,
go through this
if they're not really miserable and wanting to find out what's going on with them.
Yeah, here, drink this. It's going to be great.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, the SIBO is there's so many false negatives with the conventional medicine test for small bacterial
overgrowth. And that's why we run specialty lab testing for this, because these specialty labs, this is what they focus on. This is what they do. And so
because there was a need for it. There was a hole where, you know, they're this is becoming so prevalent and no one is figuring it out. And so that's where these specialty labs, and that's, you know, why we run a lot of specialty tests in our office in general.
That's where we get the information that we need to be able to say, hey, look, this is what's going on. This explains your symptomatology. It explains the problem that you have. It explains the condition that's going on. This is where we find a lot of those types of answers. But, you know, so we're just talking about how, you know, up to 15% of the healthy population has SIBO. 80% of the people that have irritable bowel syndrome have SIBO. And I can't even begin to tell you the percentage of our patients that mark that they have irritable bowel, whether they've been diagnosed with it officially by some doctor somewhere, or if they just know that their gut doesn't function and that's the term that they use. It's, oh, I have irritable bowel.
Right. Or, I mean, and it's funny because then the people that don't, a lot of times, you know, we still end up talking about bowel habits and the fact that, oh, wait, no, you do really have something going on.
Right.
So, I mean, they're just, it's so common. I mean, it's much more common at this point to have abnormal bowel habits than it is to have normal bowel habits. I think that we don't even, most people don't even realize what normal bowel habits are at this point.
Right. And some of these bacteria can have profound effects. I mean, some of these bacteria can affect whether or not a person can become pregnant.
Well, definitely.
I mean, this is where, I mean, we're talking about like some far-reaching health consequences that take place by not knowing what in the world's going on. It's just, I really, you know, if we find the answer for someone and it happens to be, you know, bowel related and we've got the test and we're like this, so many people are like, oh, finally, an answer. That somebody's explaining something to me. And then we're not just saying, oh, yeah, this is what it is. We're going to sit down and we're going to be like, okay, this is how we go about fixing that. This is the process that goes through. Because, I mean, anybody, any Joe Schmo can run a test and say, well, here's the problem.
Right.
The real art is in actually fixing
it. And once they're fixed, they're just, I mean, it's amazing to realize how much your bowel habits were actually affecting your life.
Right.
And so, I mean, and how much better it is when you don't have to worry about that anymore.
Yeah. All right. So we got to take another break. When we come back, we're going to finish up by talking about why SIBO can...
Some common symptoms.
Oh, yeah. Common symptoms.
I want to make sure that people know what things we're looking at.
Oh, yeah. Common symptoms. Yeah. We'll hit common symptoms and then I want to talk about why it's so difficult to treat. You're listening to Wellness 101. And welcome back to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Today, we're talking about SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And for this last segment, we wanted to talk about some common symptoms. So common symptoms of bacterial overgrowth would be things like abdominal pain and discomfort. Lots of people have this. Bloating and abdominal distension. That's another big one that a lot of people complain of. My stomach swells way out to here and they put their hands out.
And a lot of people don't even realize, I mean, they think that it's just weight gain. And it's, I mean, if it's really, if you're seeing it a lot after a meal and then it goes back down, if it's fluctuating more, I mean, that's bloating.
Yeah, that's bloating. Exactly. Then the almighty diarrhea and constipation. I'm amazed at the number of people that tell us when we ask, you know, how do you have diarrhea? Yes, occasionally. What's occasionally? Oh, 1 or 2 days a week. That's a lot.
I mean, constipation though, I feel like is even worse.
Oh,
I
yeah. Then they go like prevalent. Once a week.
I mean, yeah. And it's, you know, or the people who are constantly taking stuff for constipation.
Right.
That's not normal either.
Right.
Like,
right.
It's so abnormal. I think that people get to a point where they don't even realize that that's odd.
Yeah, that's right. Then we have gas and belching. So if you get the toots or you're burping all the time.
It's a medical term.
It's a medical term for the toots.
Can you tell that he just had a baby?
I just had a baby. He's not very old. It's the toots. It's cute that way. So if that's what you have going on, those are issues too. And these are things that a lot of people, I believe, just think is normal parts of their day, their life, their, you know, whatever. And it's not normal. It's absolutely not normal. There is a little bit of gas and is normal, right? That's just a byproduct of digesting foods, but.
And usually you won't have that at every meal.
Right.
I mean, you'll have it.
To have excessive, that's a problem.
Right.
Right.
I mean.
And if it smells bad enough that people have to leave the room, that's another problem.
That's, right. I mean.
There's issues.
Yeah. I mean, I can't believe that people don't know that there's an issue. Like, if there's ever a smell associated with any of that, you have an issue. Like, it just shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, that's true. So why is it so difficult to treat? Well, it's difficult to treat because there are a lot of factors that go into it. It's difficult to treat because modern medicine really just goes after it with antibiotics, which kills all the bacteria and then you're left with too few bacteria, and then they don't really come back anything and repopulate with anything. Or if they do, they're just like, oh, well, I don't know, just get whatever. If that's the answer, that's find a different doctor, because that's not the answer.
Well, and generally, they won't even talk about repopulating.
Right.
They'll just say, well, the antibiotic will take care of it. And because people don't know, I mean, I wouldn't have known,
right,
you know, that it needs to be repopulated. You don't realize that, okay, that's only half the problem. I'm then left with no bacteria. And I guess, you know, a lot of the doctors are thinking, oh, well, the body will just repopulate itself. I mean, it will just end up. But I mean, that doesn't happen. If you got yourself into the position where you have SIBO, your body isn't probably functioning optimally anyway. So you're not going to be able to just magically repopulate your small bacteria or your small intestine with the correct number of correct bacteria.
Right. And so modern medicine, they just throw a round of antibiotics at you and say, okay, well, you know, that doesn't work. I don't know what to tell you. But there's a study out there that actually looked at rifaximin, which is the medication that they give you when you have SIBO, when you test positive for SIBO. And it compared these botanical antimicrobials. So there's this gut protocol that's a bunch of botanicals and herbs and things. And actually, the botanical blend outperformed the prescription medication. And the botanical blend only worked on 50% of the people in one round. It takes multiple times of doing this. This is not something that's quick and easy. It takes time, work, and dedication. You got to stop eating foods you're not supposed to be eating. You got to do all the right things. That's what's important. I mean, you can't expect 100% success and only do 20% of the work, right? That's just the way it is. You've gotta really dedicate yourself to, you know, taking back control of your health and doing things on your own and doing things right and not jumping into taking, you know, prebiotics and types of foods before you should be consuming them. It's not necessarily a good thing to just jump right in and start eating a bunch of sauerkraut. And unfortunately, there are a lot of protocols that's what they do. They tell you to load up on these fermented foods, and that just creates more imbalance. It's not always the right thing. You've got to figure out what's specific to you. Don't just blindly take a test and say, okay, well, I'm going to, or don't just blindly take a protocol and say, I'm going to do this protocol because I think I have this problem. Actually get a test that tells you what's going on and go to a professional that actually knows how to fix that specific issue and knows what to do if things are just a little bit different than what you would see in a textbook case for that type of condition. Find someone and put them on your team and have them help you. This is not something that's easy. This is one of the most difficult things that we have to deal with, is when someone has SIBO in our office.
Well, and that's also why, I mean, you know, TJ takes calls from so many practitioners. I mean, we've talked before that he teaches, you know, doctors how to practice functional medicine, and it's one of the questions that he'll get the most is when people come in, okay, what do I actually do with them? So even doctors that have gone through the functional medicine training have trouble sometimes when these cases come in, okay, what do I actually need to do? So you do need to make sure, I mean, there are very few people who are out there who have been trained in functional medicine and then also have been doing it long enough that they know what to do when these specific circumstances arise.
Right. And yeah, I mean, that's exactly it. It's just difficult to see all the possibilities that could be out there.
Right.
And staying on top of it's really, really important. So, well, that's about all the time we have for today. I think we did a lot of damage here talking about SIBO and really informing people on
a lot of damage.
Yeah, doing a lot of damage, a lot of information out there, helping people, you know, understand that if you're having gas, if you're having bloating, if you're having constipation, if you're having diarrhea, if you're having all of these things go on.
Or any of the things go on.
Yeah, there could be a problem that could easily be found out and figured out what it is if you just test for it. Get somebody on your team that can actually help you walk through and fix the issue.
Right. Because there is an issue. These things are not normal.
Right. So if you'd like more information, please visit us on our website, theinstituteofnaturalhealth.com. You can give us a call, 314-293-8123. Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. Shoot us an email. We love getting messages and questions from you. We do our best to get back to those as quickly as we can. That's about all the time that we have for this week. For Aaron and the Institute of Natural Health, I'm Dr. TJ. This has been Wellness 101. Thanks for listening.